open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I would look at a rapid and I would feel scared. And then once I committed to doing it, it felt like, you know, all the energy goes forward. And then, you know, once you put on a violent rapid, it's kind of crazy, but everything goes quiet.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Author Peter Heller has had a lot of real-life adventures, but he says the biggest adventure of all came when he started imagining the protagonist of his first novel.
And it was as if this guy, Higg, was across the campfire from me on an October night with the wind blowing the flames around, and he was telling me what happened to him a few years before, and it was so thrilling. I mean, of all these adventures, it was the most thrilling thing I'd ever experienced.
Higg is the main character in Peter Heller's first novel, The Dog Stars, about a man who survives a flu pandemic that killed most of humanity. Before The Dog Stars, Heller wrote nonfiction books that document adventurous expeditions. He's been a longtime contributor to Outside Magazine, Men's Journal, and National Geographic Adventure. Heller's latest novel is called Saline. Heller talks this hour with Ron Jolly, author and radio host for WTCM News Talk 580. Heller starts off talking about his process for writing fiction.
So I start writing with the first line, and I never plot or outline because I wrote all this nonfiction. I mean, I had to make a living when I got out of college. They didn't tell me at the English department that you can't make a living writing poetry. They thought that was kind of mean of those guys. So I had to make a living. So I was a crazy kayaker and I loved to write. So I started, you know, writing for magazines. But all that nonfiction, I knew what was going to happen next because it happened. And I always knew the ending. When I finally got the chance to write the fiction I wanted to write novels, I didn't want to know. I wanted the same thrill that you get running a river in a kayak. If you run a river that's never been described or you don't know, you come around a corner in a canyon and there could be a waterfall or a cougar drinking or five guys with bows and arrows, you know, if you're on the right river. And I wanted that thrill with the narrative. You know, I wanted to sort of put on the river of the story and just let it run and be as shocked and thrilled as the reader. So I started Saline with the first line, and I'm mostly interested in the music and the language because I came up as a poet. And the first line was something like, my mother's name was Amana Ambrosio in Tupi Warani. Amana means night rain. I liked the music of it. And pretty soon that was a young woman describing her childhood. And then this young woman describes losing her father over 20 years before to a supposed bear mauling in Yellowstone. But she doesn't think the evidence adds up. And so this young woman contacts this private eye. This private eye lives under the Brooklyn Bridge in this loft with this view of the bridge and the skyline. And she's an artist. And she makes stuff out of animal bones and skulls. And pretty soon I realize it's my mom. And I was writing my mom as she is. I wasn't changing a thing. I mean, my mom had this loft and there were all these sculptures of bones and skulls. The window washer was so enamored of her work that the next day he brought her a human skull in a bucket. And he said, yeah. Mrs. Heller, don't ask. And so she covered it immediately in gold leaf, adorned it with some, and put it on a pedestal by the front door, and that's where it stands today. And so mom died 3 years ago, and I was devastated. And I think that I sort of wrote the book. I mean, I think that the reason that Gabriella's story wound so quickly to the front door of my mother is that I wanted to spend another year with her, hanging out with her. And so writing the book was a way to really be intimate, you know, with my mother again, you know. And it was neat because I learned so much about her while I was writing it. You know, you have this sort of attention that's not like any other attention that you have in the rest of your life when you're writing, I find, this sort of zone. And putting that attention on my memories of my mother, I discovered all sorts of things that I didn't even knew that I know, which is the interesting thing about fiction. You know, so often the fiction is, and the characters are smarter than I am, which is physically, you know, it defies natural laws.
So Gabriella is the, as a girl, lost her mother, Amana, to the surf. They were out hunting for rocks, mm-hmm, certain mm-hmm. rocks, and she's left with her father, and the story goes on. She loses her father, who supposedly died to a bear maul, mauled by a bear in Yellowstone. And you start with that, and you say, well, she'll have to call a private eye. And you start writing the private eye part, and you realize that's your mother. And so now the reader will wonder how much of the Celine character is your mother. For instance, in Celine, the novel, she's great with a gun. She knows how to handle a gun, all sorts of weaponry. Was that your mother?
All right, so my mom's sister was dying in Sun Valley, and she went to help her die. And I went to visit my mom to support her and to say goodbye to my aunt, who I loved. And she had just days to live. We were both very sad, and we were driving down through Haley, Idaho. And my mom said, Pete, pull over, will you? And it was a low concrete building, and it said Dick's Guns. I was like, all right. I pulled over. She gets out, opens the door, walks in, Armani scarf, click, 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 go the pumps. The guy at the end of the counter, and she's got, you know, gold scallop earrings, and guy at the end of the counter, he's cleaning a Walther on a cloth, and he's watching her like she's some strange species. Like, who is this woman? This little woman, she's petite. And she came up to the counter, and she leaned over, and her gold bangles clicked on the glass, and she said, could I see that one, please? And it was a 1911 Colt 45, this big, honking semi-automatic. And the guy said, it's a gift. And she said, no.
No.
And he said, well, you might want to start with the 22s over to your right. You know, they're a little easier to shoot. And only I knew that millimeter raise of the right eyebrow, this guy was on thin ice, man. He was like, she said, no, I'd really like to see that one. The guy came over, he took it out, he checked it, you know, he handed it to her. My mom picked it up, and I'm watching all this, I mean, and she made a stance at the wall. And then it was like I could see the cartoon bubble, you know, the thought bubble over the guy's head, and he's like,
ding.
Pretty good stance. She must watch a lot of cop shows. And then he was watching her, and he got so intrigued, he kind of looked at his watch, he was like, you know, we're going to close up in like 20 minutes anyway. Let's go shoot this thing. So we get in Dick Roop's Bronco, old rusted out Bronco, drive above Haley. There's a party spot, log, cans of bottles. He sets up seven of them. He's very patronizing, showing her how to rack it. You know, don't shoot your pretty little toes off. She picked it up. She just went, bam, 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 bam. Every bottle and can is shattered, cans falling everywhere. The last shot, she looked at him and she took and she hit the can so that it jumped. And the guys, you could not have caricatured the guy's face. I mean, Norman Rockwell could not have done it justice. He just went. And me too. Yeah. I mean, her son, you know, I was like, she had these skills. And when she died, we opened up her little safe, and there were seven handguns in there. There was that one and a couple of Glocks. There was one little 22 that you can put in a bra. And then there were all these certificates from, like, you know, combat shooting certificates. Who knew? So she had gathered these skills over her life that were extraordinary.
So that's a true story, yeah. And that's the similar story in the book. So you drew heavily upon the detail.
Yeah, I just wrote her as she was, pretty much.
So in the book, there's a lot of loss. Gabriella loses her mother to the surf. She loses her father to a bear mauling, perhaps. And Celine loses her sisters in the book growing up. There's reference to that. And that just seems to be a theme that runs through there. She also, as a teenager, Celine, had a child in high school at her private school, and the child was taken from her immediately. Is that, where does that part of the story come from?
Okay, so all the family history in the book is true, and the backstories are true. But what I did was, in a couple of places, I conflated stories of her two sisters. She had a younger sister and an older sister, just like Celine. And it was mom's older sister that went to the Putney School, And there's a dear friend here from the Putney School who works at the Putney School, came, surprised me tonight. I'm so happy about it. Hi, Allison. It's really cool. So it was her older sister that went to the Putney School back in, you know, this is 19, so she's born in 30, so it would have been 46, you know, right after the war, who got pregnant. And the story is that my grandmother went up there. My grandmother was the partner with Admiral Bill Halsey, you know, the commander of the 3rd and then the 5th Fleet, and one of the great fighting admirals of World War II. And they went up there together, and my grandmother went in her sable coat to the headmistress in Vermont and said, "You thought this was a good, you told us it was a good idea to put 100 boys and 100 boys, girls together on a farm."
Yeah.
And you're not kicking out my daughter. This is your problem. She got unexpelled.
Just like in the book.
Yep.
So in the book, Celine, that's kind of a subplot there, that Celine, Celine has a son in the book, so the son finally hears this story from a sister and says, somewhere out there I must have a sibling, a sister it turns out. So he's kind of looking, and that's her specialty, is finding missing family members. So was that something, as you wrote the book, did you try to give her some motivation? Why did she become a private detective to find missing family members, because she had lost her child, or how did that come about?
I don't plan anything. Yeah. You know, I mean, the thing about writers is writers make up stories, right? And writers really want to be smart, and that can be a problem. And the thing about it is that, you know, people ask writers, well, you know, how about this, you know, this theme that runs through, this motifs and these metaphors, you know, and this conceit and that, and you know, this intention and that, and. You know, most writers just, you know, my experience is most writers just sit down and follow their nose, and then they make up all this fancy stuff afterwards about what they meant to do. Yeah. And so when I was writing the book, I really wasn't thinking about it. I mean, I was just letting my mom be my mom, and letting her husband, I wrote as described. I mean, Pete Beveridge, I didn't even change his name. He was her Watson. He's a seventh generation Mainer, and Maine, you know, reticence is like the state bird up there. So he didn't say much. And we called him the quiet American in the family. And, you know, I just wrote him as he was. And I just let them get on this case. The case is fictional. So that's really where the fiction is, you know, is them following the clues and then the sort of drama of the people that don't want this guy to be found and the threats.
So there's a lot of mysteries, and this is not your run-of-the-mill mystery. I mean, this just has so many layers, and the characters are so rich. And it's like people around the country are talking about these people as if they're real, which they kind of are, based on your mother here. But will there be a follow-up? Because a lot of mysteries are just character-based. You invent a character, and each book comes out once a year, and then they're into some new mystery or some new adventure. Celine is a little different, but the character's so interesting. It would be fun to have a follow-up. Is there a follow-up on deck?
I don't know. I don't want to get like killed because I had a woman like corner me in Vermont, like grab my collar, and she actually pushed me against the wall and said, "There's got to be a sequel. You know, we've got to know." And I should just say, "Yeah, there probably would be a follow-up." I honestly don't know because I write. You know, I sit down and I go with the music of the language and a voice, and I suppose if Celine's voice started to talk, I would surely go there, because then I would get to hang out with Mom again.
So that's a maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, possibly. References in the book.
It's like asking people if they're going to run for president.
Exactly. Never say never. There's a reference to Bruce Willis in the book.
That's a true story.
At an airport or something.
Yeah,
is there any particular reason that you chose Willis for the...
No, it's a true story. My mom was, she was rolling her, you know, she was probably 70 at the time. She's rolling her bag through the airport, her little bag, and a hand came and grabbed the handle. Said, "Allow me, ma'am." And she looked up and it was Bruce Willis. And they got to the counter, and then Mom had to declare her Glock, her Glock 19. And she took it out of the... She had to check the bag. She took it out and put it up. And Bruce Willis just like... He looked at this little petite woman with all the gold, and he got that smile. Not the one before he kills you, but the one that... And they got to talking, and she said she was a PI, and he gave her his card and said, you know, if you and your husband are ever in L.A., you know, look me up. And maybe he wanted to make a movie out of her.
Right, yeah.
I don't know.
Well, could be a connection there in the future. Because has that been optioned for a film?
ABC wants to maybe make a TV series, so we'll see.
There you go. I want to go back. Let's see. For Celine, we might circle back if we have time and do a reading. So if you've not read Celine, Peter can give you a sample here coming up. Hemingway, in all of your books that I've read, it seems there's direct or indirect references to Hemingway, especially Nick Adams, which are the stories set in northern Michigan. What's up with that? I mean, why is every time I open a Peter Heller book, in The Painter, they called the painter Hemingway was his nickname. Mm-hmm. I think it came up in Celine. I forget the context, but what's with Hemingway and you?
So when I was 11, you know, my dad read to me every morning. I mean, every night before I went to sleep, he always read to me, and he read a lot of poetry, and he read. You know, E. Cummings to me when I was like six, which is sort of grounds for social services, if you think about it. A lot of those poems are sort of bawdy, and it was good that I didn't understand them. But I love the music of the language, and he read Treasure Island to me and stuff like that. He read Hemingway to me later. But when I was 11, I was wandering around my little school library in New York City, and I had a crush on the librarian. Her name was Annie Bosworth, and she was English. And I would have married her right then for the way she said my name. She said, Pita, are you looking for something to read? And I was like, and a great librarian, like a great bookseller, has followed your reading since you were little, you know, and knew what you're ready for. And she went over to the fiction shelf, and she pulled down In Our Time, that little book of stories, mostly Nick Adams stories about Upper Michigan. And I took it home, and you have to sort of imagine a little boy in New York City cracking that open. I wanted to do that. I wanted to hop off a slow train up in the woods in Upper Michigan and carry a rucksack through grass that wet my pant legs with dew and make camp by the Big Two-Hearted River and make cowboy coffee. I didn't know what that was, but it sounded awesome. And I wanted to not burn my tongue the way Nick didn't burn his tongue, and I wanted to especially to fish for those beautiful trout. In the end of something, that gorgeous breakup story, that little story, I wanted to have a girlfriend that could row and fish like a man and then break up with her. because Nick did, you know, and I don't know why he did. I still wonder why she was so awesome. Why did he do that? I came to the conclusion that it's because she was way too good for him, which is usually the case with men and women. But mostly I wanted to write about it all like this guy, because the prose, I had that experience of prose that I love coming straight into my heart, like through my skin. I mean, when you read writing that you just adore, it seems to sort of bypass the head almost and go straight here. And I wanted to do that, and so he was, you know, I owe a lot to this writer and to this country that he wrote about so beautifully.
And to that librarian. I was going to say, if it wasn't for that librarian that you had a crush on, would we be sitting here today?
Well, my dad, you know, he was very literary and had stacks of books, and he was always, so probably, but, you know, that was a very seminal experience, and I do owe her a lot.
Any thoughts on the importance of parents reading to children? Because right now, I think across the country, but even locally here, there are several efforts to get parents to read to newborns and all the way up through preschool and into elementary school.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many of you all had that experience, but to me, it was one of my very favorite things when I was little was to, you know, I look forward to going to bed because my dad would read to me, and I just loved it, and I think it's very important. I think once little kids I think it's like listening to good music when you're little. You know, you get used to the cadences and the beauty of the language, and you just and the pull of the story and the fascination of a wonderfully drawn character. And I think you just want more and more of it, which can't be bad.
Yeah. So in becoming a writer, and we'll touch on your adventures. I mean, you became a world-class kayaker. You learned to surf. You learned to fly. You've been on the eco-pirate ships battling the whale, the illegal whalers, all kinds of crazy things, mostly on the water. Did you become an adventurer who said, well, I like to write, so I might as well write about my adventures? Or did you become a writer who said, I'm a writer, I might as well write about my adventures? What role, how did it all
unfold? It was all together. You know, when I was little, I thought, I only have one life, but I want to do like 12 things.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of like that. You know, I knew that I always wanted to be a writer, but I always thought that you could do all this other stuff and it would just feed the writing. You know, you would meet people and hear stories. And that's sort of why I did all those jobs, partly because I loved it. I loved being outside. I loved doing physical work. And writing is solitary. And, you know, you're sitting in the coffee shop and you're basically alone, you know, working half the day. And I love being on a crew. I mean, I love being, you know, being on a framing crew or being on a little lobster boat with two or three other guys. And so... all those jobs were really fun for me, and at the same time, I was keeping journals and I was listening to people's stories. And so the adventure, you know, when I started to kayak, I took to kayaking like an otter. You know, I just love rough water, and I love being upside down. I don't even mind that. I like getting tumbled and having forces bigger than me, you know, kind of throw me around. I think it's fun. And so a friend of mine said, you know, we were skiing once and I was in my 20s, and he was a ski instructor up at Breckenridge. He always had a free pass for me. I was always broke, you know. And so I go up and ski on Mondays. And I remember driving back from the mountain. He said, why don't you combine your interests? Why don't you just, you know, you're kayaking all this crazy stuff and you're spending half your day in your room writing poetry. Hmm. Why don't you write for Outside Magazine? And so when you're young and dumb, you don't know what you can't do. And I went down to the magazine store and I picked up an Outside magazine and I looked on the masthead, you know, where they show all the editors, and I picked a name that sounded nice. She was a senior editor, Laura Hanhold. Doesn't that sound, yeah. She sounds nice. So I got the 800 number for Outside. I called up and I said, Laura Hanhold, please. And the receptionist said, just a minute. And I was like, and she said, Laura here, and I started talking really fast. And I said, hey, I live in Colorado, I'm a writer. I just had a story published in Harper's, which is sort of true. And it was just a little reprint of a college story in the reading section. It was small, but it was in there. And I said, I kayak class 5, and I think you should send me to this expedition to do this first descent of this river on the Tibetan Plateau. And there was this, just like this. And then she said, you know, I'm going to take a chance on you. You know, we've heard about this expedition. We'd like to cover it. But we don't have a writer that can kayak class 5. And I'm going to pay half your expenses. And if you write a good story, I'll pay the other half and buy the story. So I was so excited. I needed a new paddle anyway. Mine was all duct taped together, you know. And so I went and... It was a couple of rafts of professional river runners.
Where was this again? So
it was Western Sichuan, almost into Tibet, on the right beneath the Himalayas.
Okay.
A beautiful, beautiful country, full of Buddhist temples, and you know, just be gorgeous. And snow, you know, the Himalayas right there. And so we decided to do a practice run. There were three of us in kayaks. Kayaks are sort of you go out ahead and you run safety and stuff. And two paddle rafts. And there was one couple that was on their honeymoon, and they weren't. Everyone was professional river runners, and these guys weren't, but they were very athletic, strong, and they loved canoeing, and they figured if they put one on each raft, they'd be fine, because they were paddle rafts. So as we were putting in for the practice run, sort of a gear shakedown and a crew shakedown, you could see a dark storm over the mountains, and the river was rising. And it, you know, by the time we put on, it was really raucous. And I remember I was just surfing a wave and just warming up, and I peeled off, and I came around the corner, and I saw one of the rafts doing cartwheels beneath the ledge with nobody in it. And I sprinted ahead as fast as I could, and I saw a helmet in the waves. And I paddled as hard as I could up to the helmet, and I gave him my stern. He tried to grab, and we got separated by a crashing wave, and we were starting getting shoved into a bank, and I could see a log jam. And I hit the shore, And I could see him going, his helmet went into the logjam, which is like a sieve. And there was already another helmet there stuck. And I ran out on the logs and I grabbed the guy who had been in the river and I started pulling. And the other kayaker was right there, this other guy, Scott, and we grabbed him, we pulled him off onto the shore. He was still alive, and he was one of the Chinese guys. And then we ran back for the guy who had already been there, and we pulled, and he was stuck. And we put a Z-drag on him, which is a pulley system, and we couldn't budge him. And the river was rising, and you know, we held his head up, and we held his head out of the water, and then the river rose, and he died.
He died.
In our arms. And we had to paddle back across the river and tell his wife that her husband had just died and they were on their honeymoon. So the next day, we gathered by the river. The water had dropped and it was just such a pretty river again, you know, class four. And we sang Amazing Grace, and I had a book of Chinese poems. I thought for my first magazine assignment I would bring a book of poems from the place to get the heart of the place. And it was a book of Tang Dynasty poems from like the 9th century. And I read one. And then we went up for 2 weeks. The Chinese revoked our permit. We went up on the Tibetan Plateau in these grasslands where people were herding yak, like with dragging travois behind their horses and living in yurts, like sort of like the Great Plains in 1870. And no Westerner had been up there since 1959. It was surreal. And we were all grief-stricken. And I came home. And I called Laura Honhold, and I said, I can't write your story, I'm sorry. And she said, what happened? I sort of unloaded for like 45 minutes. So you could have heard a pin drop. I mean, she didn't say a word. And then she said, you go write that. And that was their submission for the National Magazine Award that year.
Wow.
And it was an odd way to start in journalism. And I knew that if I didn't get another assignment right away and paddle something hard, that I might not kayak again. So I got invited. I got invited on this Kiwi Russian expedition to Tajikistan and to run this thing that it was the very end of the Soviet Union, 1989. It was to run the Everest of rivers, and the Soviet Union was supposed to be the hardest river. And the last team that had tried it had lost 5 of their 11 guys. And I was going to be one of the kayakers. There was a Kiwi and me, and it was a big expedition. We were the guys who were going to go out front and sort of, you know, check the line out and tell people to get out and stuff. And it was mythic. I mean, you know, we landed up in these mountains in the high Pamirs above Afghanistan, and there was a dead snow leopard right by the camp, and there were the river came out of a hole in the ground beneath a glacier, this big river, just a big boil, and there were wolf tracks in the sand, I mean, on and on. And the Russians and Kiwis, I mean, this was like a perfect antidote to the last trip, because the Russians and Kiwis were like oil and water. You'd get to a really tough rapid, you'd wave everybody over, and they'd get out, and the Russians would squat and start chain smoking. And they'd look all grim, and it was like the weight of history. It was like Tolstoy, and the Kiwis, they'd be hopping around the bank, going, "Oh, she'll be right. Oh, I see a line. No worries, you know." And the guy that had to navigate between the teams was the translator Vanya, and he learned all his English from Frank Zappa records, and so he could sing all those songs. And one night he pulled me aside. He said, "Pete, I'm guiding geology expedition in the same area here." Last year, and we are camped, and next drainage over is camped international team of scientists led by French guy looking for Yeti. So one night, Pete, I take Swiss Army saw, and I've got plywood deck from raft, and I cut foot. And I put handle on foot, and you know, rock creek here, and moraine, and snowbank, and I make tracks. He said, Pete, next day they discovered the tracks, made international headlines, and you can look it up. And he said, but only one problem, Pete, was all left feet. Oh. So clearly the scientific rigor, you know, not peer reviewable. anyway, it was a perfect antidote, and that launched this sort of career of adventure writing.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up, Peter Heller talks about joining the filmmakers of the documentary The Cove on their clandestine mission to film the slaughter of dolphins in Japan.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. let's return to Ron Jolly's conversation with Peter Heller, author of Saline and the Dog Stars.
So your first assignment, a guy dies in your arms. The second assignment, you take on the Everest of rivers, where five people died trying it before. You were successful. Are there maps? Are there notes from previous expeditions? I mean, how do you know when you're, you know, like when you play a golf course, you have notes on what the next hole is like, or do you just go blind?
Well, they had us, the kayakers. They were blind. But they knew, I mean, the guys knew that there was, you know, after we put on, they knew that within, you know, 20 miles there was going to be this really deep canyon and it was going to be bad. But we didn't know, we didn't have descriptions of the rapids.
I've seen footage, video of some of these waters that you guys could paddle. And it makes Taquamenon Falls in the UP look like a faucet dripping.
I don't know.
I mean, they go over and straight down into the water. And was there... You obviously weren't afraid. You accepted these missions because people died, and it's very easy to die out there. I mean, you can flip and not be able to flip back up, or you crash into a boulder.
I got scared. I mean, I would get scared, yeah. Sure. But there were times, especially on that trip, you'd stretch your kayak in the morning. You'd stretch your spray skirt over the kayak in the morning, over the cockpit, and I would wonder, is this the last time I'm going to do this?
Did you say something about it being almost a divine feeling to finish and get through the rapids at some point?
Well, in a big rapid, once you make, I mean, the thing about paddling, and it's probably the same with climbing, and it's like everything we do, it's sort of like it's a metaphor for your life. And what I found was that I would look at a rapid and I would feel scared, and the big rapid. And then once I committed to doing it, and started really focusing on where the line was. Once I'd made the commitment, okay, I'm doing it, it felt like, you know, all the energy goes forward. And then, you know, once you put on a violent rapid, it's kind of crazy, but everything goes quiet. Oh. It's almost silent. And you're just responding. You've already, you know, you've envisioned every stroke through the thing, where you're gonna, you know, paddle to on the edge of a hole and how you're gonna, you know, get around it and it just, then it's just like this flow and it's all quiet and it's really beautiful.
So after that, one of your missions, you actually didn't paddle. You were on the, you were assigned to follow this expedition down the Tsangpo River, this gorge between the in Tibet, in the Himalayas. And that one resulted in a book, Hell or High Water.
Right.
Hell or High Water. What was the significance of that mission? If the previous one you did was a river that nobody conquered before until you and your crew did, what was the significance of this Tsangpo mission?
I think they wanted to do the deepest gorge in the world, and it was a gorge that was sacred to Buddhists. I mean, this gorge is like incredibly magical. You got to imagine a gorge in the Himalayas that is so deep that it's subtropical on the bottom, and there were four species of leopard, there were tigers. Mm. There were these cloven-hoofed animals called takin that are endemic, only exist there. And you're in, you know, there's 200 species of rhododendron and bananas that have never been described. There's so many of them. And straight over your head when you're on the riverbank are 25,000 foot peaks blowing snow. It's that deep. I mean, this is like 5 miles straight down. And it's, you know, only one team had been through there. It was a National Geographic team that that documented the place in 1998. And we were in 2002. Nobody had ever kayaked it. And these guys chose to do it in the middle of the Himalayan winter because that's when the water would be low. You know, so many of the tributaries would be locked in ice and the water level would be low enough. It was still huge water. And so it was wild. I mean, in the river, of course, you know, it was so crazy. But on the ground, people almost died almost every day. It was just, you know, we had to climb up around these spurs, and we were in the bamboo forest in the snow, and there were tiger tracks. I mean, porters were deserting. We started out with 60 porters, and they just kept...
Were the porters carry all of the gear?
They carried a lot of the food, and they would just... deserting because it was so rugged. And then you get deep in there, you go over this pass and down into the river again, and there's like a cave. And in the cave are little butter candles and prayer flags.
Hmm.
And you're like, holy cow. I mean, this is like one of those Chinese, you know, those old pen and ink or brush and ink landscape paintings, you know, of the mountains in China, you know, back in the Tang Dynasty. And, you know, that's what it felt like. Hmm. And there are leopard tracks on the beach. You know, it was like the most mythic thing. It was crazy.
So you were, I mean, how remote were you there? I mean, there was
nobody for, you know, 1,000 miles. I mean, it was like really something.
I think when I read some of those adventures, I think Everest, and I've read a bit about Everest. John Krakauer was a climber journalist, and he went on a mission in 96, I think it was, and 8 or 9 people died
trying to
summit. Yeah. And one guy in Goodhart, Michigan, which is a Hemingway country up the road here, he was on that mission and survived, and he wrote a book, and he said the fact that a journalist was along, nobody knew about until he joined them, and he felt there was pressure on the guides to summit, to, you know, because they didn't want to come out with an article that said, we almost made it, or other people have made it, but we didn't. So he felt there was pressure, and that might have caused some of the deaths. Was there any dynamic like that with you as you were on the crew chronicling this this mission?
Nah, these guys were consummate pros, and they knew what they could paddle and what they couldn't, and that's why nobody died.
Where did they find these guys?
Where do you find anybody crazy? Yeah. I don't know. They're everywhere.
That's one right here. All right, another kayak adventure. This one did not result in a book, but it did result in a documentary that won an Academy Award, I believe, The Cove, and that was on kayak.
No, that was on a surfboard.
On a surfboard. Can you tell us about that project?
So I got an assignment to, I went to the Telluride Mountain Film Festival, and the guy that had helped me with the Tibet book, he was an old, what did he do? He analyzed U2 film. Remember the U2s that flew over Russia? This guy had the highest security clearance in the government, and he was one of the analysts who took those, and a very interesting guy. But he loved looking at the Earth from the sky, and one thing that captivated him was the Tsangpo Gorge, because it was such a feature, you know, and so he had studied it for years and the history of it. So he had helped me when I was writing that book about the history of the place. So I met him there, and he said, have you met this guy, Captain Paul Watson of Sea Shepherd? He's over there at that table. I think you should meet him. He's radical.
Yeah.
So I went over, and I introduced myself, and this guy had this, you know, white mane and a beard, and it's kind of safari jacket, and he shook my hand, and the first thing he said to me was, I've sunk half the Norwegian whaling fleet and half the Spanish. I'm like, no one had ever said that to me before. And I heard him speak to 2,000 people in this auditorium. You could have heard a pin drop. And when he was done talking about the whale that he tried to save in a Zodiac from a Russian harpooner, and the whale that got harpooned, this big gray whale, and how in its last dying throes, bubbling blood, how it reared up and used every ounce of muscle to stay away from crushing the Zodiac because it knew that they were trying to protect him. He told that story, and watching the whale's eye go beneath the surface and the connection, I still get, and people were crying all through that auditorium. And at the end of it, he said, would you come with, you know, he knew I was a journalist. He said, would you come with me on my next campaign to Antarctica to, you know, harass the Japanese whaling fleet and attack them? I was like, yeah, of course. I mean, what else would I say? And I got, you know, National Geographic was very loath to, you know, send a journalist because A, they didn't want to glorify eco-terrorism, if that's what these guys were, and B, they didn't want their journalist to go native. So they made us sign a letter, both Watson and myself, that said that I was a non-participant, I was a journalist. And I had that letter laminated, so it was waterproof, so that I could put it in my dry suit so that if we got sunk and the Japanese picked us up, I could wave the letter and say, you know, don't put me in jail and feed me whale meat. You know, it's like I'm a journalist and you need to send me home. And I actually had that letter. But I got the assignment. I was excited about it. I had my little duffel bag. I landed in Australia. I went down on the docks in Melbourne. You got a picture, a prosperous dock with cafes and restaurants, and tied up is this all black pirate ship, flying a Jolly Roger, and I walked up to the superstructure, which is the part that sticks up with the bridge on it, and there were all these skulls and crossbones with the names of ships, Isba One, Isba Two, the Marilled. They were all ships these guys had sunk or rammed on the high seas, and I was like, wow. And then they told me it was a vegan ship, and that I sort of hid my fishing gear. And then the guy who showed me my berth was this Hell's Angel tattoo artist, and he said, you have to sleep in your clothes. And I was like, why? He said, in case we get sabotaged by, you know, like the way the Rainbow Warrior did Greenpeace, in case we get blown up, that could save your life, the time it takes, you know, getting out. So then I started, it dawned on me that this might not be such a lark. We sailed south, we picked up a helicopter, 2 days south of Tasmania, all the welders came on deck and welded a big blade to the port bow. Triple reinforced steel, T-steel, and it was sharp, and it was for gutting the hulls of ships. And that's when I knew that this was no lark at all, that these guys were totally committed and were willing to die to save a whale. And it was very, actually, sort of moving that these all these people were willing to sort of stand up for another species. Where does that happen? And as I learned more, there were documentary filmmakers on the ship, there were biologists, there were people involved in all sorts of environmental fields, and I began to learn more about the crisis of the oceans. And you know, it was not too long into the trip that I sort of did go native, and you know, I really believed that what they were doing was very important. And you know, for all the sensational stuff about the Jolly Roger and the can opener, all that, they had never hurt anybody. What they were really doing was being sensational so they could attract people like me to write stories so that they could publicize the crisis of the oceans. Because Paul Watson told me, he said, look, if we can't save a whale in a whale sanctuary, you know, during a moratorium on commercial whaling, if we can't save a whale, what chance does a sea cucumber have? What chance does a non-charismatic crab have, or a seagull? And it made a lot of sense.
So that was the book that resulted in Whale Wars. What was
Whale
it?
Warriors?
And Whale
then,
Warriors.
And then yeah, and then okay. Animal Planet made the TV show.
The Animal Planet made a TV show out.
But
Whale Wars.
So anyway, getting to the Cove. So yeah. The guys who were making the Cove movie about the dolphin slaughter in Taiji, Japan. It's this inlet where they herd the dolphins in, and they slaughter them. They call the prime females for dolphinariums. They read the book, and they called me up and said, "Hey, we really loved Whale Warriors. We thought it was really cool. Would you come with us and be the first journalist to come in with us when we sneak into the cove and plant the cameras to film this thing? This cove was very. It was razor wire surrounding it. They had armed patrols." Because they did not want anybody documenting this thing, because they knew that if the public saw this, you know, there would be international outcry. There already was, but to have, you know, graphic footage was something that the Japanese really did not want. And so I went in. They said, you know, you bring the camo, we'll supply the face paint. And we snuck in at night into the cove. We planted cameras that looked like rocks. It was made by Lucasfilm's lab. You know, they made them look just like rocks. We had cameras that look like bird's nests. We planted them at night. We went up on the cliff and in camo and started filming. And then when they started killing, five of us paddled in and on surfboards. And what they drive the pod in, they net it off, and they start spiking the. And
you had a helmet cam, didn't you?
They put a helmet cam on me. And when we paddled out, the inlet was already paint red with blood, and it was a pod of about 50 little pilot whales, which are like big dolphins. And they was like 12 left, and they were huddled against the net. There were like three nets strung across. And they were terrorized, and they were just, we paddled out, they huddled away from us against, you know, they were traumatized. And we formed a circle, and we began to pray, and it was a surfer circle in prayer, and it's what you do when a surfer buddy dies, and you make a surfer circle and you pray. And we were praying for these pilot whales, and they started to relax. I mean, they started to see that we weren't a threat, and they started just to flow along the net. And then around, and then a little baby spy hopped and looked at us, and I knew that within an hour they would all be killed, and I just started to cry, and all of us just started to cry, and that was in the movie. You know, we filmed, and then the fishermen came in and attacked us with these poles, and that's in the movie. When you see the fishermen attacking the surfers, that was filmed on my little head cam. And I got home from that assignment, and I lay in bed beside my wife every night, and she would fall asleep, and I would just weep. I mean, it was the worst thing I've ever seen. I mean, these animals were self-aware. They could hear that, you know, they're part of their clan, you know, their family being killed. They knew what was going on. And what it profoundly, the message to me from those last 12 that were up against the nets when we were there, what I got from them is that it's really important to speak for the ones that can't speak for themselves. I mean, that's our responsibility. I mean, we are screwing things up a million miles an hour. We're in the middle of the sixth great mass extinction. It's caused by us, and you know, some of us need to start speaking for the ones that can't.
Did that movie... the movie, the documentary that won the Academy Award in that instance, and then the whale slaughter that you documented in your book, did either of those bring awareness to the situation and improve it at all to eliminate that kind of killing? Or has it had any kind of positive?
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, when the movie came out, The Cove, they nominally stopped killing dolphins, but they killed every other small cetacean. So it was a PR move, you know. They still kept killing false killer whales and pilot whales and all that. But, you know, it did raise awareness, and there's a lot more people, you know, concerned about it now, and the Japanese government's getting pressure. The same with the Antarctica, you know, thing. Australia with, you know, I think that the things like the book and the TV show, the publicity around it helped the political will, the momentum for the Australian government to bring a case against the Japanese in the International Court in The Hague, and the Japanese lost, and they were told to stop, and they did for two seasons, and then they decided, heck with that. What are you going to do? We're going again, and now they're whaling again.
So you've had great adventures, but some really low points. I mean, thankfully document that, but to have to witness that in your adventure writing days, and for the last few years you've been turning out fiction. Is there a difference? What is the big difference between writing nonfiction and fiction?
So I've always, you know, I wanted to write fiction ever since I picked up that, you know, In Our Time, and I did. I wrote short stories for all those years, but I had to make a living. I started writing for magazines, and I got joyfully diverted. I mean, what could be more fun for someone who loves to kayak, to go around the world and do this wild stuff? It became clear to me that the ecosphere was unraveling after a few years of doing those stories. I wrote more and more environmental stories. How cool is that? You know, it's very fulfilling. But when I had 9 months out a few years ago, and I thought, you know, I don't think I have to take a magazine story for 9 months. It's time. You know, I want to write the novel I've always wanted to write. And it was like coming home. You know, that's what it felt like. It was just taking that other hand from behind the back, just having free run of the imagination. And as I said, you know, I just start with the first line. And I'll tell you the cool thing about fiction. I mean, I sat down, I started with that first line that my name is Hig, one name, Big Hig, if you need another. If I ever woke up crying in the middle of a dream, and I'm not saying I did, it's because the trout are gone, every one. And as soon as I heard that, I was in there, I was listening, and I sat up and I thought, okay, tell me. And it was as if this guy, Hig, was across the camp. I go to the coffee shop, and it was as if he was across the campfire from me on an October night with the wind blowing the flames around, and he was telling me what happened to him a few years before, and it was so thrilling. I mean, of all these adventures, it was the most thrilling thing I'd ever experienced. And I would come to work, and I would just sit down. I'd say, don't think, just listen. And I would listen. And I wrote the book, and, you know, I mean, I was I'd laugh out loud. I'd burst into tears. And when I got to the last page of the Dog Stars, Hig is lying out under the stars, and he says, "My favorite poem is written by Li Xiangyan in the 9th century in the Tang Dynasty. When will I be home? It's the poem that I read for Dave 25 years before on the side of the river. I didn't even know that I knew it. It goes, when will I be home? When will I be home? In the mountains, in the rainy night, the autumn lake is flooded. One day we will be back together again. We will sit in the candlelight by the west window, and I will tell you how I remembered you tonight on the stormy mountain." That's the magic of fiction, you know. It just. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask about loss, because as you say, you make it up as you go, which is amazing, but there are some themes or similar, like rivers are in all of your books, and Hemingway is in all of your fiction. But everybody loses something. They lose loved ones, they lose the life they knew, and is that on purpose, or where does that come from?
You know, I've thought about it because people have asked about it, and I think that we go to writers that we love because I think that writers draw from almost like mountain springs, like certain well springs that are up on the mountain. And some writers, we love them because the spring, their spring water, you know, it tastes sweet, or it's sort of dusty, or some of the springs have a metallic taste or a mossy taste, or some are cold and some aren't. But we love the taste of their water. And I think my spring just has to do with a lot of loss, and I'm not sure why. You know, I'm not a depressed person, but I feel like maybe that's our job. You know, I mean, we get born, and then pretty soon we just start to lose stuff. You know, one after another, and it's kind of our job to make meaning and to make connection and to love despite, you know, and because of, you know, the losses that we face every day and every week and every year. And I think it makes us very special.
Well, how about if we do a reading, if you wouldn't mind?
Okay.
I think that people, many people have probably read you, maybe some here haven't, so it would be great to hear from you.
Okay, I'll
your
read.
Your words.
I'll read. Yeah.
This is Celine is the 68-year-old private eye with her husband. They've been hired by Gabriella to see if her dad indeed had been mauled at Yellowstone by a bear and was dead. And they're driving across Wyoming now in a camper, her son's camper, headed to Montana?
Yep, heading to Montana. And so here they are driving north. Celine didn't really relax until they turned up into the Sweetwater Valley and the ranges on either side got close and their flanks were dark with timber and the meadows were green. So were the irrigated fields of the ranches lying along the river, the neat white ranch houses peeking out from groves of boisterous cottonwoods. She opened her window and let the late afternoon wind pour in, and it smelled of alfalfa and wet fields and the river. They drove into Lander just as the sun was settling into the long escarpment of the Wind Rivers. Just three more latitudes north made a difference here at the end of September. The air pouring through the window was chilly with fall, and she could smell wood smoke. The aspen were already turning on the higher ridges, slashing the shoulders of the mountains with ochre and gold. Glorious, this time of year. It was good to be out of the city now, good to be rolling, traveling, letting her losses toss in her wake. The cold currents would bring them around again, surely, probably tonight as she slept. And if she woke up to the strange silences of a new town and lay in the dark listening, she would welcome them home and taste without bitterness the oddly sweet grief of missing those one loves. But now it was wonderful to forget for a few hours, to be traveling, to hear tires hum and thwop on cracks in the pavement, to come to a T in the road above a creek whose meadow was dotted with horses, roans, and Appaloosas, and smell smoke from the wood of trees that didn't even grow in the east. Celine didn't feel like cooking. Pa offered, but she waved him off. "Let's have ribs," she said. "Isn't that what they eat in Wyoming? And then let's go find a pullout somewhere to make our new home. I feel a little like a hermit crab." "Carrying his house on his back?" "We had one as a pet, you know. Mimi brought it home from Simmons Point one day in her glasses case. Mummy had a fit." "You were all suckers for a stray." "He was not at all a stray. I'm sure she plucked him from a very fine family where he'd been quite happy. It made me mad, kind of a lesson for me in not offering help where it isn't needed." "Did you make her put him back?" "No, she was irrationally attached. At the end of the summer, I abducted him and put him right back in the little tidal pool where she'd found him. I'd been with her that day. Anyway, over the summer, he'd been quite spoiled. She dropped all manner of food into the pickle jar. One Friday night, she brought him to the movies. She swore to me that he crawled to the edge of the jar, came half out of his shell, and watched. Ginger Rogers. She swore on the Bible that he moved all his little legs like he wanted to dance. She said he was an almond and wasn't allowed to dance. I finally figured out she meant Amish. I had learned about them from our nanny, and I'd been telling her about how they don't have zippers, which she thought was hysterical. She changed Benny's salt water twice a day. When it was clear that he was actually growing, she found several empty snail shells and dropped them in. He inspected them and found them lacking. I told her that probably they couldn't have holes. She thought he'd like to have windows in his new house. Finally, she found a beautiful, glossy, symmetrical shell all covered in irregular black spots like a paint pony and with no pinholes. Benny took one look and moved right in. Years and years later, as an adult, she told me she thought of that as one of her proudest moments. Isn't that odd? So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Oh, and then Pete half smiled. It was his way of giving vigorous applause. So they drive through town. They pass a Loaf and Jug in the Safeway and a gas station turned burger joint and two stores featuring Native American crafts. It was that time of day or night that happens only a few weeks a year at certain hour in certain parts of the American West. The sun sets behind mountains, but the cloudless sky that is more than cloudless, that is lens clear, clear as the clearest water, holds the light entirely, holds it in a bowl of pale blue as if reluctant to let it go. The light refines the edges of the ridges to something honed, and the muted colors of the pines on the slopes, the sage-roughened fields, the houses in the valley, the colors pulse with the pleasure of release, as if they know that within the hour, they too will rest. Maybe Celine thought this way because she was exhausted. She was. It had been a long time since she'd driven that far in a day. Main Street curved to the right, and they passed the Double Ott Motel, which made them laugh as there were probably patrons doing things there doubly ought not to do. And Celine abruptly threw the wheel over and executed a U-turn that startled Pa and squealed the tires. "Practice," she smiled, 27 miles per hour, pretty good, didn't even think about rolling. Never know when we might need one of those. I was thinking we ought to head back to the Lander Grill. They might not have ribs, but I bet they serve a mean steak. Thank you so much for coming to me.
That was Peter Heller talking with Ron Jolly. Peter Heller's latest novel is called Celine. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.